Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast, because every failure brings you closer to success. Or closer to more failure. But, you know, that's life, isn't it?
How are we doing with our projects, kids? Are we chipping away? Tommy, how are you coping with having a deadline now?
Yeah, after last week. Probably need to renegotiate the deadline. But
what? It's 6 months
away. You finished the book. How hard can it be?
I don't think I have after last week.
Interesting.
Now. Just after the feedback and actually thinking about it, and I'd always kind of treated it as my silly little sales, but it was just something I was doing, what have you. And, I mean, you're both very generous in your feedback. And it did make me think maybe there is something there that actually needs taken a bit more seriously rather than just going, right, let's get this finished. Because that's where I got to on it. Was, right, just get it out of the way so I can do something else. Yeah, so just thinking about it, maybe there's a few more bits to write into it and a bit more proper editing to do on it rather than just trying to put a lid on it, really.
Maybe even
taking it more seriously and rather than just going straight self-publishing, do something proper with it, which sounds a bit scary.
We're talking trad publishing.
It sounds possibly
do something proper with it.
Yes, in a way, but it sounds very I don't know, overconfident or a bit bullish to say that.
No, I think
on the basis of a silly little book.
I'm really pleased you've said that.
Well, all that really means is sending it to people.
Yeah, but it means getting it in its best form possible and actually having the confidence to say, look at this. This is good. This is and selling it. Do you mean kind of saying this is what it is? But it's been rattling around in my head this sort of last week since last week's episode, and I kind of think, oh yeah, obviously don't think, yay,
oh god, to do
bloody this is actually so I still need your guys written feedback on it, so I can pick up on those bits and bobs.
I was going to give you some notes, wasn't I? Hey Tom, you could invite publishers and agents and things, invite them to a training day,
full training session, Chad Nadworthy session.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, and like say, and just for reading this, you know, this invitation. Here's a little sneak peek at the first chapter of my book, and like style your submission
I had actually written a like a little synopsis to send to publisher type things a little bit back.
Yeah.
And I was relatively pleased with it because it starts and just says, Chad Nadworthy is an arsehole. and then explains what it's all about. But so anyway, that's kind of where I am.
I'm really pleased to hear that, Tom.
I
will give you those notes that I promised.
But I think, to make it into its best, the best that it can actually be, rather than just trying to put
it. I think sometimes just the
idea.
Act of sending it to somebody who potentially, like an agent or a publisher or something, just that act is going to make you look at it very differently and really...
Yes, a bit more critical in my own eyes, rather than letting stuff float or going, well, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Also, your best ideas that you've ever had will occur about 5 seconds after you've submitted it to somebody. Like once you've finalised it and sent it off, that's when you'll suddenly go, no, it should, oh, bloody hell.
Yeah.
I was really pleased after my comment last week about the world of sales, you know, moving on a bit from the 90s. I got put in my place by listener Jay Flea P, who said, just for clarity, not very long ago, I was on a sales training session where the trainer actually said, in response to what he deemed an obvious question, does Dolly Parton sleep on her back? It still exists, guys. So there you go, Tommy. Your instincts, I think, were probably right there.
I think, unfortunately,
it really does.
He's ripe for the ribbing still.
Yeah. John, what have you been toiling? Doing more of your murder mystery?
Yeah, still chipping away at that.
You still doing your 500 words a day?
Sadly, not. No.
Right. Okay.
No, I started writing another short story, another short love story that I had an idea for.
Oh, okay. Well, that's all right. That's all right.
Yeah.
That's all right.
So I'm still writing.
Yeah, good.
Do you know what? I suddenly realized that I've got, I think, 7 writing projects on at the moment.
That's quite a lot.
Seems a lot.
It is. It might be too many.
How many hands have you got? Hands. Two, haven't you? You're a two-hander.
I've only got the two.
Yeah. Seven. No, seven is a lot then.
Quite restrictive, the whole two-hand thing.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm thinking maybe I need to tuck some away and stop thinking about some of them, because I think 7's too many.
Yeah, I think it's good to have a big one and a couple of little ones on the boil, isn't it? So you've always got somewhere to go if you just need to have a break but keep writing.
Yeah.
Seven might be too many. I mean, even God rested on the seventh day, didn't he?
He only had six projects on the ground.
Yeah, he didn't start another book on the Sunday.
And so. I think he probably has more than two hands as well.
Yeah, I reckon.
Well, he's got as many as he needs. He's got as many as he wants and just one at the same time.
Whoa.
That's what God is. One massive hand.
Oh, by the way, I got an email from the lovely Chris Paling the other day.
Yes, did you?
To say that the paperback version of his book, A Very Nice Rejection Letter, Diary of a Novelist, is out, and would we mind giving it a little mention?
Oh, we're not going to mention that, then, are we?
So,
I don't think so.
Let's not talk about that.
Nah, we're not going to mention that. So.
Yeah.
Did you just say no to him on the email?
Yeah, I said, yeah, no way, mate. Sorry, we've got better things to do.
So. What we're going to say, oh, it's a really good book, buy it, it's a good kind of Christmas present type thing. Or whatever.
Yeah. I think that's what he wanted us to say.
We're not saying that.
We don't have time for that kind of stuff.
Not really. No. If people want to buy his book, they'll go and buy his book. It doesn't matter what we say, does it?
Exactly.
I mean, we would say it's really good. It's a deep insight into kind of the inner workings of the publishing industry.
That's right. It's very funny.
Turns. Yeah.
It's quite painful, a little bit cathartic.
It is. It's got sadness. Yeah. But
we're not going to talk about it now.
No one's ever listened to us before, are they? So why would they start now?
I mean, there's episode 16. If people really want to know about it, they can go back there, can't they?
And find
out all about it that
way. Yeah.
So we probably
say buy his book in there as well. I know it's the hardback version and this is the paperback version, but we probably say go and buy the book, don't we? Because it was a good book. Oh well, swings and roundabouts.
There you go.
Swings and roundabouts.
Unlucky.
Nice of him to get in touch, though, isn't it? Sorry, we couldn't be more helpful. But nice to hear from you.
Hey,
speaking of books,
I've just finished reading a book by Agatha Christie. Have you ever read any Agatha Christie?
Seen Poirot.
You can't have ITV dramas, Dave. That doesn't count.
No. I still love that moment where some bloke knocks on his door and says, I got a parrot for Mr. Poirot. And he says, it's Poirot. And he says, all right, I got a Poirot for Mr. Poirot.
Oh, one of the greatest comedy writers of the 20th century, Agatha Christie.
Yeah, of all time. Good old Agatha.
She is actually quite funny. I got to be honest. Right. She's a lot funnier than I thought she was, or I was expecting her to be. Poirot is a good character. He's a proper bell end, but he's funny. I wasn't expecting it.
What were you reading?
I was reading Peril at End House. It was sort of as research for the murder mystery novel, kind of.
You've got to love the Agatha Christie titles, though, aren't they? They're just so...
Yeah, they just cut to the chase, don't they?
1920s, aren't they? Just kind of like...
Yeah. But she's good at laying out the puzzle for you to try and solve. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're paying attention, you can actually solve them.
Yeah.
She lays it all out there.
Yeah, well, satisfying. That's a big thing, isn't it?
But yeah.
She doesn't cheat. Yeah. There's bits where you kind of go, oh, hold on a minute. But it's all above board.
It is. Yeah, no cheating and no sort of deus ex machina or whatever.
Yeah. Well, the hand of God, isn't it, that, basically? Because God is just a big hand.
The one massive hand
one
of God.
One massive hand sweeps in and just, sorts it all out.
Or the hands
clicks,
of God.
Clicks. Can you imagine one big click on that God hand?
Yeah.
Seriously. Clicking the fingers. Boom. Droid. No, she's a good one. We should get her on the podcast.
Hey.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Come on?
Yeah.
We can always ask. We can always ask.
Does she like it, Zoom?
That'd be just like most of our Zoom calls where we just go, is anybody there? Hello, can you hear me? Is anybody there? No, obviously we'll stick to live people for guests, probably.
Probably best. Probably easier. Although it could be quite an interesting episode,
John, did you have anything pertinent to say about finishing that book, or did you just want some kind of award like a primary school child for reading a book?
Yeah.
No,
do you want a sticker? Give him a sticker. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll take a sticker.
Have you moved up to the next level? Are you on to gold books now? Is that what it is? Yeah,
it's a very easy
I'm
book
a super
to read.
Reader.
But very short.
Well, maybe you should move up a level. Have you tried Jan and John? Davey, have you been putting pen to paper?
No. I haven't. Although I was still thinking about it. I had to do had a meeting with the police force today.
Did you?
Which is not as interesting as it sounds. Writing some.
You could have made it more interesting by just telling us.
I was interviewed by the police today.
Yes, that's better.
to some sort of recruitment campaign that I'm writing for the police, and I thought, do you know what? Maybe this would be a good opportunity to speak to some police about some of the things in the book.
Whoa.
That'd be a good sort of conversation starter, wouldn't it?
That's a good idea. How did they take that?
Well, they both.
This isn't your one phone call, is it, Dave?
This is it. Yeah, I'm really going to have to hurry up because this 50p isn't going to last forever. No, they were both just people who worked in the communications department and didn't know the first thing about police work. So it seemed like a good idea, but I don't think I'll get much out of them.
They didn't work in the major crimes unit.
They didn't. But I have been thinking
about it. Two people in the marketing
team
going, no, sorry, we don't know anything about that. is there anyone that could help? Not really. Can you think anyone, Keith? Well, there's Chief Inspector Bobby Brown. We could get him down. Dave just going, yes!
Yes!
I knew it! I bloody knew it! Sorry, I got to phone John and Tom. And you bloody wankers! Listen to this! Tell him your name!
But, you know, I've been thinking about it, but I just haven't had the time to write anything. So
fair enough, Dave. That's fair enough.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's
frustrating.
It is very frustrating because I've really got lots of ideas, but no chuffing time.
Well, it'll come back round.
Yeah, hopefully all those ideas just build up like a massive tsunami.
Just burst inside you. An embolism of words. Yeah. So I look forward to that.
Sounds good.
But enough about what we've been doing. We should talk about somebody else for a little while, shouldn't we?
Yeah. We spoke to Nels Abbey quite a while ago now. So normally what we do before an interview is go, oh, so we talked to this guy and he talks a little bit about this, a little bit about that. Oh, this is your favourite bit. Yeah, I like that bit too. But it was a long time ago and actually none of us can actually really remember. So it's going to be kind of an exciting ride for all of us.
We can all listen to it together, nice, can't we? Go on a little journey of discovery. I remember it was really good. I think it was really good.
Hopefully it'll be good. Guess we'll have a listen and see. Should be all right, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
Every so often, you read a book that gives you a bit of a smack round the chops, and that was my experience with your book, Think Like a White Man, A Satirical Guide to Conquering the World While Black. For the listeners who haven't read it, can you give us the gist? How do you normally describe it?
Well, I think it's almost in the strapline. It's a satirical guide to conquering the world while black. And I really didn't want to put the word satirical in the actual strapline, but what happened was that booksellers and publishers and everybody else were quite scared of it, so we had to make it clear to them that it was a satire. So it's a book that plays upon my experiences in my previous career in financial services, and it looks upon everything that happened and how I navigated my way through the corporate jungles to somewhere near a decent level of pay too. And it's looking at all the horrible maneuvers and everything else that many people from my sort of background, black, Afro-Caribbean, and I'm sure other people from other ethnic minorities or marginalized people have to go through themselves too. I just thought, let me just put it down there and look at the exact things that I learned and those lessons and the squalid maneuvers, and then just put them into a book and try and sell some copies or try and infuriate some people and try and make some people laugh and think at the same time.
How did it start, Nels? Was it out of pure frustration, or was it planned, or was it something you were always going to do, or did it just kind of, how did it start?
It's a very good question. So I was always, my ambition was always to be a writer, to do what I do now, which is work in media, to do my writing work. And I always thought that was my calling in life. And it's just, with that stuff that you, I just couldn't get a job. So when I graduated, I applied to DEF and no one had me. I even applied for jobs in Afghanistan at the time, and Afghanistan was on fire, and I was even good enough for them there even. So I just in the end, I ended up in banking, and then in investment management to be specific. And it was kind of, you're going in there day in, day out. I was doing quite well. I was throwing myself into anything and try and make the most of it. But it became pretty clear that there's something very weird going on in these sorts of organizations. And it wasn't just myself. It was also my friends, too, who we all went into so many of us went into banking. It was almost like, at the time, it was the only industry that was accepting university-educated black men of my class or so. And that was pretty much it. So it started off, so I was writing consistent, even though I was working in the bank and everywhere, in the asset investment management company, I was always writing when I go home. I'd always finish the day and I'd go and pitch an article to every newspaper that would have me. 95% of the time, they would actually turn me down. I would just always write. I wrote a blog. I did anything I could do to keep writing.
Yeah, so what sort of things were you writing, Nels?
Just blogs on all sorts of things, on politics, on economics, on technological growth or so. I used to write a blog on The Wire before anybody watched it. And by the time people got round to watching it, I deleted the blog. so that's pretty much... So that was my most short-sighted thought ever. So I just used to write about things that I used to... At one point, I started writing a blog about anything that... I wanted to do 1 year where I documented every penny I spent in public.
Wow.
And I think I did it for about 3 days and I just cancelled it because a friend of mine sat me down and just said to me, I don't think this is what people want to read. So that was it. So I really just throwing myself into anything or anywhere. I just really wanted to have a creative outlet. And so I did quite a bit of stuff. And I started to get noticed by the BBC. When I'd write about Africa, the World Service would always call me up and have me on. And it was quite bizarre because once upon a time I was on the World Service and they described me as an Africa expert. And I thought, so that is the craziest description I've ever heard in my life. An expert of a couple of billion people, hundreds of different cultures. So I wrote about pretty much anything and everything. But I always knew deep down that eventually I was going to have to get very, very serious if I wanted to be a writer and really knuckle down and write something long form. I just thought to myself, what do I know? What do I really know that I could really write a book about? And then it just dawned on me one day when I was in the office and I was going through the normal frustrations of office life. I know a lot about this life over here. And I just thought, let me just write a book about it. And I started to, so even the term, Think Like a White Man, it's a term that my old mentor used to say to me. He'd always just tip me off and just say to me, well, you've got to think like a white man. He was this East London Cockney Asian guy, and then, although he's described in the book as black. But yeah, so and he's an interesting chap, and he would always come up with these interesting terms, nuggets of advice. And that was one of them that really stuck with me. And I thought, let me pay homage to this guy. And, let me make that the title of the actual book itself too, which was actually something a lot of us had to live by at the same time. And that was pretty much it. So, yeah.
Who were you writing it for? Were you kind of just writing it for yourself at the time? Or did you kind of have somebody in mind? Like, were you writing it for your friends, or were you writing it for... Were you hoping that white people would read it and go, oh, well, that's interesting?
I wanted to write something. I wanted to write something. So if you go back in the day, to, say, if you go back and look at very, very cutting-edge comedians and people who perhaps our parents would have listened to and they know they shouldn't be listening to them, or the type of stuff that you would actually hide when you're listening to some real content that you would hide, not pornography or so, because everybody still hides that to this very day. But I mean stuff like if you listen to Red Fox or Richard Pryor or a certain type of comedic content, that wasn't
just Jasper Carrot.
Yeah, exactly, here and there. So yeah, so we had I wanted to write something that was edgy, that was edgy from my perspective, that had that feeling once again too, that you knew this was a lot of it, that it was true, that it was true to life, but these are things that you could not say out loud in public. And I just wanted to say out loud, I really didn't have that thought of who was the audience in mind. I really didn't. I don't think I really approach any of my writing like that. I write it as if, hey, do I like that too has got me in trouble sometimes, is not knowing who your audience is. But I once pitched an article on the economic brilliance of Suge Knight to some Spectator blog, which was, they just said to me, I think you've got the wrong people for this. But so I just didn't really think it through in terms of like that. I was writing stuff that was A, therapeutic to me, B, I knew people. I wanted people to actually read and to make people laugh and think and possibly squirm a little bit too. And see at the same time to really put the story out there of what the experience is like, to document the day of what it was like working in this sort of environment, which is a good reflection of the corporate world altogether and the struggles of it. And I think that's what we did.
Yeah,
it's a really good way of getting that message across, because it's kind of a bit of a Trojan horse then, isn't it? Where you're kind of entertaining on one hand, but then there's some real truths and realities mixed into that as well. Makes it very soluble for all readers.
Yeah, thank you. But thank you. That's very nice to hear, actually. But it's funny because just the other day I spoke to my publisher and they said to me that, look, one of the biggest problems they had with the book and why it hasn't sold a million copies just yet is because a lot of people, booksellers, the book industry or so, found it quite scary. They really didn't know what to do with it or how to position it. So it was satirical, but it was satirical in a way that Britain was not really used to. So satire from a British perspective has its establishment, has and I admire the establishment of British satire, Chris Morris, Iannucci,
Yeah.
Of course, Ricky Gervais. These are guys who I really and truly do admire and I look up to. But when satire is coming from a perspective which I'm coming from, and it's radical, it's black, and it's anti-racist, and sometimes too it might use crazy language that's going to make people feel uncomfortable, it's something that is fairly new that we don't really know entirely yet where to actually how to position it. Certainly not in book, maybe TV a little bit. So Munya Chihuahua is doing actually, I just realized Munya Chihuahua's surname actually sounds like it could be comedic, but I don't forget that might be his real surname. But you get that sort of content out there a little bit more in TV. But as far as books concerned, given the nature of books in which you have to read it yourself, do you get the context? Do you get the setup? Do you get the punchline? Do you get it all? And some people might not get it. And then you've got the whole Twitter thing, which gets you can spiral out of control.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was all up in there a little bit. So it wasn't easy for the publisher, because publishing is still very, very white, extremely white and middle class. So for it to break through as it has done, as in for it to at least get out of the shelves, and for people, or I walk into a bookshop, for example, and you see the retail assistant or the person there or the bookseller, they really love it. It's such a relief. It's such a relief that it got there. So that was a huge achievement.
I was going to ask you about the fallout after writing the book. I'm guessing there must have been, you know, some interesting reactions in the press and on social media. Do you have a kind of a favourite example of that? There must have been quite a lot of sort of white victimhood crybabies, you know. I can imagine.
Even the funny things that you get the normal, but what if I write a book called Think Like a Black Man? And I say, well, just write the book. I'd actually love to read it. So I would actually love to read it. I am a fan. I'm a fan of people. I don't really care how. It takes a lot for me to take offense to something. And so I'm a fan of comedy and really good writing. One of my favorite writers, for example, is a guy who I don't really agree with, but I really do find his work to be always on point. Richard Littlejohn of the Daily Mail. I find Richard Littlejohn's opinions to be objectionable, but I find how he writes those opinions to be hilariously funny, to really be good at what he does. So I can see that, for example. I can see the appeal of him. Same thing as so many of these guys. Jim Davison, for example. I saw him on that show with there's a guy, he was on a show on ITV where they're investigating post-George Floyd anti-racism. And the guy from Diversity, the dance group.
Oh, yeah.
And then when Jim Davison walked out, the whole thing was hilarious to me, because I thought to myself, this is Jim Davison doing what he's been doing since the 60s and 70s, since at least the 70s, maybe even the 60s. Yeah. And he's good at what he does or so. He's effective. But I can see the appeal. I can hear the appeal of it. Also, I can see the appeal of it. I see where it could potentially be funny. Yeah. And funny, in my view, is money. So we go to where it might be offensive sometimes. But sometimes, so you always got to go there and let those opinions out into the world.
He's back on tour now, so he must be doing something right, eh?
Again, London's a very different world. So outside of London, once you go into the countryside where I grew up, for example, it's a very different world. It's a very different England.
Yes.
It's a very different England. And I can see, again, London, through 2022 London, is one experience of England. But when you go to different parts of the UK, so there should be actually like a year rating in terms of where different parts of the country are. In terms of which is this part of the country stuck in the 70s?
It's a bit like,
is this part of 85?
It's a bit like wind chill, isn't it? When they say, well, it's 7 degrees, but it feels like zero. It's a bit like that.
Yeah, it's 2022, but in places it might feel like the late 80s.
Exactly. So when I grew up in a place called Bath. I was fostered for the first 9-10 years of my life. And I grew up in a place called Benson. And Benson, when I grew up there in the 80s, Benson, I would often say to people, in terms of like race relations and progressiveness and whatever else, so when I was growing up there, Benson was stuck somewhere in the 50s. When I then came to London or so, you were dead firmly in the 80s in the UK or so, which compared to some parts in America or so, you'll probably stay a little bit, we'll probably stay a bit behind them, and probably ahead of some parts in America too. So it's a different world there is. So in terms of progressiveness of race as a nation, it doesn't really exist. It depends on where you're actually living and the experience you have too.
Yeah, very much so.
I'm sure if Think Like a White Man was written by somebody who was living in beside a farm in Benson or so, he'd probably have a wilder story to tell than I did. He was just working in the corporate world.
Yes, I imagine so, yeah. It'd be quite different where I grew up as well.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in the Cotswolds.
Oh, sounds nice.
Yeah, where's did you say Benson? Yeah. Where is that?
Benson is in Oxfordshire. So if you went to Oxford University, which I'm assuming at least one of the three of you did,
all three of us.
So if you've ever been to a place called, no one's ever heard of Benson, unless you've ever heard of RAF Benson. But what most people have heard of is Didcot Parkway.
Oh, yes.
Didcot Parkway is the closest thing Benson has to civilization.
I think we've all been through Didcot Parkway.
Yeah.
At various train journeys.
I say people never get off, just stay on the train, and that's pretty much it. So, yeah.
Nils, is there a sort of sense of freedom when you're writing? Essentially, you sort of Ghost wrote this book as Dr. Boulay Whitelaw III. Was that sort of a conscious thing when you started writing it, or did that come along as you were going, this idea of sort of making it someone else's opinion almost? Did that give you a freedom to be, I know, even sort of more direct with the
just
things
asking
you were saying?
Dave, did you chicken out, Nels? That's what Dave's asking. Was that just chickening out?
I think that to a degree it probably was. But also at the same time too. So I'll give the story of it. So I'll give you the story of what happened there. So I became a dad in the year 2014.
Congratulations.
And, thank you so much. By then would be an awkward story, it was my dad. My missus wanted to go and spend some time in Ireland. She wanted to go spend a bit of time with her family. They were on the coast in the south of Ireland, a really beautiful part of the world, and with our newborn daughter. And I was working, this was about March 2014, and I had this idea in my head that I was going to write this book about being black in the corporate world. And I just felt to myself, I'm about to become a dad and all my time is about to go. So I'll be splitting my time between work and a baby for the rest of my days or so. And then I just thought to myself, okay, so darling wants to go over to Ireland. I do not want to go. It's funny, I'll take a step back for a split second. The very moment I became a dad, this very moment right now, as I was just left the room after I cut the umbilical cord, I just walked out of the room for a couple of moments and the telephone rang. And I thought it was one of my best friends to find out how my missus was doing. And it wasn't. It was actually a recruitment agent. And he said that there's a company that's really interested in hiring me. Mm. And I was sick and tired of the company I was already working for. So I just said to him, yeah, sure, I'm interested. I went to go speak to them. And then, but what was funny is that, so I took that new job. So I had 2 weeks to spare. And because my missus wanted to go to Ireland, I thought to myself, I'm going to find some time to go somewhere quiet, tranquil, and somewhere I could really concentrate on writing this book that I promised myself I would write. So I hopped on a plane and I went by myself to Vegas, Atlanta, and Miami just to go and
quiet trip to Vegas.
Yeah, straightforward. And I could check myself in Vegas, where I spent the first 4 days. I checked myself into this really nice hotel room. And this is not a tip. If anyone's thinking of becoming a writer or so, this is not a typical writer experience. This was a banker experience, one that I have too much financial difficulty I've since turned my back on. But so I checked myself into the hotel in Vegas, and then because in Vegas, if you've ever been there before, you realize that the rumor is that they pump oxygen into the room so you can't sleep.
And I
knew that was good, so I didn't want to go there and sleep. I wanted to go there and work.
Oh, clever.
So I just stayed in this luxury room for 4 days straight with the jacuzzi and everything else. So I would pop out occasionally to go and buy myself some food or go for a walk along the strip for inspiration. And I just wrote about 20,000 words over 4 days.
Wow.
And then I thought they were really good. When I started reading them back a couple of hours before I was about to catch my flight to Atlanta, I realized they were rubbish. I just deleted them. Then I then got to Atlanta and I did something similar too. And I was reading it back as I was heading from Atlanta to Miami, and I realized it was just rubbish. That it just sounded like I was just moaning and complaining while I was trying to be very politically incorrect or whatever it was. It's when I got to Miami and I sat down on Ocean Drive and I just met somebody who was almost in character himself. And it just dawned, he was almost in character as he was walking by. And then, I don't know what I said, almost, he was just a weird guy. I can't really explain how, but just a weirdish looking guy who just had something about him that made it seem as if he was acting to me. But I could feel from the vibe I got from him was that he was acting, or he wasn't revealing who he truly was to the world. And he felt more comfortable in that regard. And it just, something just went off in my head. And I thought to myself, okay, why don't I just write this from the perspective of a crazy professor of white people studies, who's this crazy character or so, and that becomes the vehicle for the comedy. And then I started to write, and I felt the words started to come a lot easier. It was a lot funnier. It felt a lot better. It was a lot better to read. And that is when the journey really started. So after two false starts, that's when it really started. And it started on Ocean Drive in Miami, is just one weirdo was passing me by or so, who was just probably similar to myself, too scared to be who he is. And there he was. And the rest is history. They clicked from there. So it certainly did.
Right, boys, we're booking a road trip.
let's go to Vegas and not know what day it is.
This is just an interlude. Carry on.
No, it's interesting because I'm glad you've told us a little bit about your sort of family life, because I was doing a little bit of research earlier and there are some quite amazing quotes about you on the internet.
Oh dear.
Well, this isn't going to be good now, is it?
this was from, I'm not entirely sure this was the Wikipedia. It was a version of Wikipedia. Yes. So it said, Nels Abbey's age is not released to the media. With a look at
he's
him,
had a lot of work
we
done.
Guess he's mid-30s.
Yeah, I did.
And then it says, based on his age, we guess he is married. Like most people, his age is mostly married. There is less possibility of him not married.
Is this an amazing... this is a brilliant idea for a website. It's Wikipedia, but it's just
really vague.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. There is less possibility of him not married too, as there has been no hint of marriage from him.
I think I know the website you're speaking of. My sister, I was on Question Time a few months ago, and my sister called me up just as I was about to go on, saying, "Dude, they're already investigating you. You've got to be careful what you say."
And Nels just said to her, "Don't worry, they will never find out my age." They'll just have to guess.
I'd love it if there's a video of Fiona Bruce saying, Nels Abbey's age is not released to the media. With a look at him, I guess he's mid-30s.
I'm just hoping that when you're on Question Time, they introduced you as Nels Abbey, the World Service Africa expert. Just you sat there going, what? No, wait, no.
I think they've probably forgotten me at the World Service now. I haven't heard from them in a long time since I started to... I think I said one or two things that you probably didn't like, so they forgot me.
Who did you piss off on Question Time?
Question Time, I don't think I annoyed... Actually, I did. On Question Time, I think I annoyed... I think Andrew Neil wasn't too pleased with me or so by the time... Because Andrew Neil just was fresh from GB News, and then me and him were going back and forth about GB News. And
that's strange, because he's normally quite chill, isn't he?
He's normally in charge. It was a unique experience for him that he wasn't the daddy this time. So it was a different experience for him. But it was an interesting one altogether that you were there. I was going on Question Time, and Andrew Neil, fresh from accidentally setting up a far right news channel, is there claiming that he had nothing to do with it. So I just thought this was a unique experience. Let me just get this one. This is one for the books, and off I go. On to the next one.
Back to your book briefly, Nels. Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question. Just, I suppose it's a question about what's next, but the book is it's quite bleak in a way. It's funny, but it's got a kind of... It's not a, guys, we can all live as one if we just try a bit harder sort of message, is it? It's a book that wants...
Isn't it funny how hopeless this all is?
It is. It's like, it wants the reader to be pissed off. You know, you clearly, you want people to... You were saying before, you ideally want people to come away feeling slightly ashamed and, you know, leave people questioning themselves.
I wanted people to think.
Well, people like us, anyway.
No, I would say, do you know, the funny thing is that I don't think that, I don't believe in blanket concepts or so. I think even though in the book, sometimes I spill into it, largely out of laziness purposes. but I don't really believe in the whole concept of a blanket guilt of anybody whatsoever. I don't think anybody else does too. I didn't want shame or guilt or anything to feel. I just wanted people to actually just think about things, and particularly in the corporate world. When you look at it, that we often don't really realize it, but in the corporate world, is where you're at, you're most minoritized. If you're at work, or at least, especially the more elite the organization, the more minoritized you are. And it becomes increasingly more difficult to handle those things. And sometimes you see some people walk away from those situations with very, very significant mental health or even physical health situations. And that's not just for ethnic minorities. I mean, practically, and I don't make any scientific claim because I have no scientific training whatsoever, but I think I've known four people in my life who've developed an ailment called rheumatoid arthritis. And all four of those people developed it after going through a stressful period at work. And it's a debilitating disease, or so it can impact your ability. Basically renders you disabled gradually. So, and I'm not a doctor or anything else, but I just found that fascinating that two of them I worked with, one of them was close to me and the other person was just somebody I met. And it was the whole thing, just I was going through a really, really stressful period at work and how people react to stress sometimes. Again, I make no medical claims whatsoever, but how you react to stress sometimes, or stress can sometimes manifest itself physically in you. So it's just something we all need to be careful about. And it's not just for ethnic minorities in that regard, it's just for everybody, women in particular. Of course, we've seen the Me Too movement, which has revealed nightmarish stories for very famous and powerful women. But when you're then looking at just normal day-to-day women or so, who don't have that platform to go out and speak, there's all sorts of things they're not saying. They're not able to say in public or so. So it's a fascinating world, because again, the corporate world or the professional world, there's such a power imbalance between different people, and that power imbalance can be exploited mercilessly.
Yeah.
The more reliant somebody is on a job, the more susceptible they are to exploitation.
Yeah.
And I felt that was the situation I just had to deal with in this book. So there have been times, for example, where and so I don't really think I'm a recognisable guy in London. When I go outside of London, I go back to Benton, for example, 6 foot tall, 16, 17 stone black guy. Yeah, very recognisable.
You stand out.
I've been told to stop using bad puns in using that also, but I was going to make something STD related. But the key thing about it is that I was coming from a lecture in Goldsmiths University, and I was outside. I was just about to catch a train. I was in a hurry to catch the train. And then somebody just stopped me in the street and just said to me, "Nels Abbey." And I said, "Yeah, that's me." And the guy just gave me a really big hug and wouldn't let go of me for the best part of a minute. So and then I realized he was crying.
Wow.
And then he said that, "Yeah, your book saved my life." And then they just, and I was just like, "Well, thanks so much." And then you'll think to yourself, "Well, mother effing, you've let me miss my train." But at the same time, too, you're still thinking that, "Hey, I've got to stay here and talk to this guy and then find out what's going on with
him. Get him to leave an Amazon review."
pretty much the key. I think whoever, the funny thing is that it's happened so many times, not the crying part, but the stopping you in the stress. But that happens to all writers. But it's stopping you in the, when you touch somebody with your art or whatever it is that you do, people, you're touching somebody out there. You just don't know where that stuff will go to, where it'll take you to, and where it's gone to itself. So it's all sorts of people just contact you from around the world and say, "Hey, I really got this." I get a lot of messages from African Americans increasingly now because the book's starting to take off over there. And it's just that element of how that plays out for you.
Yeah, they're the moments that make it all worthwhile, though, as well, aren't they? I guess
it does make it worthwhile to a degree, but because given the nature of the subject, it makes it clear that it's good for people that they know that they're not alone. So I meet a lot of people. So I held out Human Resources in particular out for notable criticism, and I found it quite nice that a lot of HR people have been contacting me to actually come and to offer me work, to come to work in their organizations, try and help them improve things. Because number one, we write a book called I Think Like White Man. It's not the easiest thing in the world to walk inside a corporation and say, "Hey, hire me." They're just different. They automatically think, "Yeah, this guy's for the National Front or something," but he doesn't quite look it. So it's a fascinating thing. But a lot of people, notably women, I must add, who work in human resources, really did find the book, notably white women, I must mention too, found the book really, really touching and really swore by it. So they consistently called me in and said, "Can you come speak to us about this? Or can you come help us review this policy or help us do X, Y, Z?" And it's a good feeling.
One of the things that struck me most, I think, was hearing that in a way the worst kind of racism isn't really the sort of overt, sort of extreme. It's not your EDL nutter hurling abuse at some rally, really.
Those guys
are quite easy to deal with in a way. You can sort of box them off. But the biggest problem is the invisible structural racism that still exists in companies and in the media and in the police, which is much more insidious.
Yeah.
It's much more difficult to deal with because it's hidden and because you sort of talk about how it forces you into a kind of a trap. You have to collaborate with it in order to get on.
Yeah, you see that.
And that really struck me.
Well, you see that happening quite a lot now in Britain in particular. So even at high-level Britain, at the highest levels of British society. And in Britain, we are notably, actually in America too, they're notably vicious. I always compare Britain and America on these in relation to two things, because we're dissimilar but fairly similar in certain regards when it comes to the whole race and race relations, racism thing. But it's the collaboration with racism for your own progression is real, and it really does. It's painful to see it happen, but it happens so much all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're right. I wanted it to make you laugh, to make everybody laugh, to make you think, but at times it's going to have to be uncomfortable because it's an uncomfortable subject.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes too, you want to make any progress or so, you've got to get outside your comfort zone.
Quite agree. And, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And that's what we do in this book at times.
Yeah, absolutely.
It feels like it's almost like a sort of step one of a process. So step one is explain what it's like from your point of view. And the step two, it would be, you know, what can we do to change it? How do we move forward? Like if you were suddenly made king, what would you do to help change the situation?
Yeah, come on, Nils. In a couple of sentences, solve global racism.
King Nels would actually pay reparations after Africans and their descendants and are bankrupt Britain in the process. And that would be my first step. And then once Britain is bankrupt and humbled or so, then it comes back to some sort of clear negotiation for them. I think in interest of it, it's a very, very good thing. I think that if there's one good thing that's come out of the Black Lives Matter movement, which in some points it wasn't managed too well. Some points it was. Like, for example, I didn't like the way in which the movement was shifted to focus on iconography and statues and that sort of stuff. Also, because whether a statue stands or actually falls or so, it doesn't cost anybody anything.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, when it comes to any progress, particularly when it comes to black people, as in terms of any ethnic minorities, it's normally the concessions we often get in our concessions that don't really cost anything, that have no cost associated with it, that whether or not there's a statue of some guy. And I often say to people too that, look, prosperous communities don't have to stomach statues or any form of iconography they don't like. Prosperity comes first, then anything you don't like goes immediately afterwards. It's not the other way around. So we should have just focused a bit more on the economic side of things. But I think the one good thing that many good things came of it. One of the good things that did come of it is the fact that let's calibrate discussion the four of us are having now, that we're able to actually discuss this. And you want to know. You want to know. You want to know more. You want to get to you. The appetite for progress is there. Everybody, I mean, one of our good friends, a writer called Elijah Lowell, always points out to me whenever I get on somebody's nerves. He always points out to me that you have to recognize one thing. Yes, you may have gotten somebody's nerves. No, or yes, it may have been justified. But the reality of the matter is that you are definitely going to be the villain in somebody's story. Everybody's the villain in somebody's story, just the way it is. And nobody wants to be the villain in anybody's story. We all want to be Superman. And even Superman was the villain in somebody's story too. But the key thing that we have actually, that we just need to consider here, just the ability to talk to each other and really get to understand these things a little bit more. Because once you know it and you recognize it, then it's up to you. I often say to be the old saying is, once you know better, you do better. Mm. And I think that's probably what we'll be seeing more and more.
Yeah, hopefully.
So in terms of what will King Nels do for a day or so, I think we're in the right first steps right now, which is we talk about this a lot more, we learn a bit more, and then we start to do better. We start to look at policy and how certain policies impact certain people, and existing policies, how they're impacting certain people in harsher ways, and start to change accordingly. So there's so many different things that we have to change. There's root and branch. They're the small cuts, and there's the big slashes. And I think that all of them really amount up to better living and how we heal them.
Yeah. Good answer.
It was a very
worthy answer, Nels, but I think we're all a little bit disappointed you didn't just say king for a day. I'd just fuck off to Vegas.
It's
where you do some of your best work.
Exactly, it's probably where I do my worst work. I go to Miami. That's where everyone
funny.
I'll be on Ocean Drive, king for a day. I'll be at Prince Harry definitely me or so. You wouldn't see me around here again. I'll just be somewhere hoovering, shoring up my long-term future with my beautiful wife. And leave me be. Good luck to you, viewers. There we go.
I was queen for the day, I'd probably be really fucking confused. I mean, how does it work? Do you just wake up as queen? Do I wake up in my bed? Or am I suddenly waking up in some fancy four-poster in Sandringham? And if that happens, will the queen be me? Will she do my washing? Because I plan to get the bed sheets done while the weather's nice. I'd be well annoyed if she just lounged around expecting to be waited on hand and foot.
Well, I tell you what, if we could bring our... Just to bring our sights down from sort of being king and changing the world, we can try and tie this interview into the sort of this season of the podcast. So this season of the podcast is all about us making our big pitch to a TV exec about a show that we've been working on, right?
Okay.
And it's an ensemble piece, and I think it's quite important for us to have a diverse range of characters in it.
Yep.
So... how can we, as three white guys, how can we achieve that without straying into, like, tokenism or stereotype? How can we create sort of authentic, believable, diverse characters?
I think it's a very good point. It's a very good question, actually. So I think of... I'm going to ask you, what are your favourite TV shows, first of all? What sort of TV show are you pitching, and what are your favourite TV shows?
Give me a few minutes to think about
that. Let me take a step back. Tell me a diverse stereotyping character that you see on TV, you think, you look at, you be yourself. This is a stereotype. Hmm. So I'll answer my question first.
Yeah, go on then.
I don't think this is a stereotype, but I think my favourite TV show, other than The Wire or Sopranos, all the great TV shows that all of us watch, The Sopranos, which is fantastic. Even The Sopranos, for example, I don't know if you guys ever watched it, but there was some... The Sopranos is vicious on stereotyping. The portrayal of black people and women, and even Italian men too, my brother-in-law's Italian, so whenever he meets somebody, my brother-in-law and my cousin's actually Nigerian-Italian, and my brother-in-law is Italian, and so whenever he meets somebody, the first reference point somebody makes to him is, have you seen The Godfather, or have you seen The Sopranos, and you just say to me, it's racist, Nelson. And I say to him, yeah, I can get it. Like, it's literally everybody. But the funny thing about it, my favourite TV show, when I think of all TV shows I've made over, say, the last 22 years, is a show called The Boondocks, which was a cartoon, an African-American cartoon, that was looking at African-American society. And one of the characters in it is possibly, I think, is one of the best characters written, at least this century. It's a character called Uncle Ruckus. And... he's basically a black racist. He's a black racist. He's a black guy who hates black people. And everything about him is just rooted deeply in absolute, unfettered racism. But making matters worse, he's not some successful guy. He's basically a manual laborer of the lowest kind. He works about 12 jobs. And he's been assaulted by the police. He's going through every form of racism possible. But he's always a conduit for racism. He just identifies with racism. You name it. In his house, he has a picture of Ronald Reagan. In fact, when there's one point when he goes to heaven, when he has a dream when he goes to heaven, and he gets to heaven, and Ronald Reagan's welcoming into heaven or so, and he starts talking. Reagan starts talking to him about, I hate black people too. Reaganomics, it's in my name. It's got my name in it. Don't forget, the crack, that was me. The crack epidemic, that was me. And I thought to myself, what they did there, and what I thought was really, really brilliant, and in terms of the type of character they created, was actually the one that actually looked at certain stereotypes in that show altogether and tried to subvert them. And tried to actually almost feed you the stereotypes you've been craving, that you've been led to believe, but flip them on their heads to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And I thought that was absolutely brilliant. I don't think writing characters if you need to write a character for a TV show from a culture that you might not. So if I want to write about, say, a Sikh woman, I probably don't know that much about Sikh people. I don't know that much about... I don't know... I want to date a lovely Sikh lady. I hope she's okay. I hope she hears this. Wherever you are, I hope you're doing fine for yourself or so. I never forgot the heartbreak you left me with. But anyway, other than that, I have nothing against the Sikhs. So other than the heartbreak I was left with. But the funny thing was that if you said to me, Nelson, write a Sikh character right now, I probably not know anywhere near enough about them to do it. There's enough about Sikh people. Mm.
Some two-dimensional heartbreaker.
It would be a woman in the full burqa or so, which has nothing to do with Sikhism, actually.
Just literally going around breaking people's
hearts. That's it. And but what I would need to do, essentially, is probably just find somebody who I know, do a lot of reading, of course, spend some time there, and do a real deep dive, understand, attain a real deep dive understanding of it, and try and get out when I want to get out for it. You look at David, I think it was David Simon who wrote The Wire, the gentleman who wrote The Wire, so, and it was something Simon. The gentleman who wrote The Wire. Was it David Simon who wrote The Sopranos? Whichever one it was.
If only there was a blog we could look this up on.
Yeah, if only someone hadn't deleted the only blog.
Exactly. But the guy who wrote it, you guys are killing me out here.
Yes, David Simon. David Simon wrote
The Wire, right?
Yeah, there you go.
He was a journalist, so he spent a lot of time deep diving into the actual community and trying to understand different types of characters and what drives them. So if you look at certain characters, so many subtleties that were in there, if you look at, say, the drug dealers, different types of drug dealers, you're looking at Idris Elba's character, who was a drug dealer driven by money, who was a money-driven businessman also, who was using the drug business to actually try and elevate himself to different levels of society. Then you look at Avon Barksdale, who was a very, very clearly reputation-driven character who wanted to make sure he was respected in the streets because he knew that brand is something that's going to have to trade on for a long time. But then when you then take a look at, say, characters like Omar and Slim Charles, who were basically muscle, who were street muscle, and one was a stick-up guy, that means he robbed drug dealers. But they had a code of ethics amongst themselves in which they didn't actually harm each other, but they understood each other, and they understood the game, and they recognized there was actually a code of ethics to how the actual game was played. Stringer Bell didn't respect that code of ethics, whereas everybody else in the game did. And there's such a unique subtlety that you really wouldn't understand unless you've done a real deep dive of how these characters think, behave, and work. And I think that's what really distinguished this show from pretty much anything else, that it was really a deep dive into the mindset. There's nothing more refreshing than that. That once you really understand it, once you really understand a person or a culture or a subset or anything else, and you really about the deep dive, then you can start to play with the character a little bit more. I really don't subscribe to this whole concept of a black person must write black people, or so white people must write white people. I think you can write a good show. It's so taxing. There's so many years it will take of your life that you just need to make sure you're getting it done and done well and done right. And I think that's pretty much the key thing.
So what I'm hearing is that we've got to break the habit of a lifetime and actually do some research.
Well, see, it's funny how you hear stuff differently, isn't it? What I was hearing is we just need to scrap any diversity and just write it about middle-aged white guys.
I think that would be
easier.
I think that would be a disaster.
Although we could chuck in a Sikh lady. I just had this idea.
Sikh lady who breaks a black guy's heart. But
she's a bit of a heartbreaker.
She'll probably. But I think that's pretty much it. So what we often find, and I think it's a deep thing here that you guys are embarking on this process, which I haven't done just yet myself, or since I haven't successfully pitched anything to TV just yet in terms of a long-form show. So I'm probably not the best person to ask about it. But I think that's probably, in terms of how I do, I try to get deep dive understandings of people and their, whatever their code of ethics might be, code of morals, and those unique things that you're going to bring to the surface about them that really makes you different to anybody else. So if you look at the character Omar, homosexual, stick-up guy, who's a man who just robs drug dealers. So it was such a complex character. But then again, too, he maintained the ethos and ethics of everything. So it showed that there was a clear understanding. And even if you look at Omar's character, too, when you watch him again, he actually wouldn't kill people who were like him. So when he had the run-in with Slim Charles and he actually caught Slim Charles, he could have killed him. Because Slim Charles didn't beg for his life and didn't actually make any excuses or anything else, and he respected the game. He didn't kill him. But when another character who was also on street muscle actually started to beg for his life and started to say, oh, well, he started to try and negotiate a way out of it. So he killed him on the spot because it was a code of ethics, and that guy violated the code of ethics too. And I think there's some, I don't want to go deep down on the work, because I know this is no longer 2015 where the whole nation's obsessed about it. But the key thing about it is that it was such a deep thinking of trying to know the world that character actually exists in. And I think when I watch something, that's really what I like to see. That's really, really what I like to see. And sometimes too, there's actually colorblind casting, in which a character is just black by nature. The fact that a character is just black or gay or whatever it might be, or so, but they just conduct themselves in a way that you would never know, that it's not brought to the surface of their character. So you wouldn't know. It's just, So
I guess that's it, isn't it? It's like, as long as you know that character inside and out, that's the kind of main thing, isn't it? Because I think there's nothing worse than when you see something where a character has clearly just been sort of, let's just throw in a black guy, or let's just throw in a disabled woman or something. Just a sort of tokenism, and there's nothing, they're not like fully rounded characters. They're just obviously there to, to tick a box. I think there's nothing worse than
There isn't.
Well, obviously there are worse things than that. But
there are, exactly. There are a couple of things that are worse than that. But it's almost like the whole Richard Littlejohn test, that you've got to ask yourself, have I just thrown in a burqa-clad Muslim lesbian in a wheelchair just for the sake of it? And I think that's pretty much that's his whole thing also. But it's funny, but it does actually give a bit of a test to that. Are you adding something to it? Is there something about this character? Or have you just actually just written something that's actually just it's blind, that's colorblind, or something, and you just cast the person into it, which is also permissible, which is also fine at the same time too, for in the short term, but in the long term too, people who understand the culture or anything else probably want to know a little bit more about him or her or they, and take it forward from there.
Yeah, that's cool.
Good advice. I mean, it's partly the joy of writing as well, isn't it? Is kind of inhabiting other people.
Absolutely. In fact, for example, one of the biggest things the biggest risks I took when I just started writing, Think Like a White Man as a new father, was actually going to a place called King of Diamonds in Miami, which was a strip club, a world famous one. And I went there on the most dead night, and I actually sat down with a lady who works there, and I sat down there for 4 to 5 hours, and she broke down the politics of commercial sex without selling it.
Because I did wonder where that anecdote was going for a while, but
she broke it down for me in such a way that was so deep. And the only thing I really regret about it is I regret two things. One, I didn't maintain contact with her, and two, I didn't put enough. I let my editor take more of it. My editor cut about, I think she cut that by about 75%, because it went into a lot more detail, where it just spoke about so many things she taught me about sexual politics. And I just realized that there's parallel with this in the corporate world too. But it was just interesting to speak to somebody who's in the explicit business of, I'm here to sexually excite you, but I'm not here to have sex with you. So, and how she just had, again, it was the code of ethics that she actually really laid down. How she really explained it, and then she was able to explain the economics of what happens when you violate that code of ethics, of how it pushes the price down for everybody else, and it was just fascinating to hear. I would never have known any of this if I didn't go there. It was a risky thing to do, but it was a risky thing to do. I'm so glad my missus understood that I wasn't there. I was some thirsty punter going to a strip club just weeks of us having our first child together or anything else.
That's really interesting. Well, it's either really interesting or it's a cover story. One of these things where you've told a little lie at the start of it all. You've told this little lie and then you've had to keep going with it because you just can't stop. And it's just growing and growing and growing.
And it's turned into a whole book. You've written this whole book as just a cover for going to a strip club in Miami.
I don't know. Anyone else? Did the bit where Nell said very conveniently, just dropped in, that he hadn't stayed in touch with her? There can be no proof. It's just a kind of a... It just seemed a little bit too...
No, I just said, her name was... funny thing, it shows to understand how wet behind the ears I am, or I was in relation to it. She said to me her name was Cece, and I put that in the book as that was her name. And then pretty much so many people, so many readers said to me that you do know that's just a stripper name. That's not really a name.
That's not a name.
It's like her saying, my name is Champagne. As in, well, everybody should know that that's just a stripper name. And so when she said my name is Cece, I just took her board. Like, oh, yeah, that's an interesting name. It was a funny experience because I think I put it in the book too. I'm pretty sure I did. We spoke for so many hours. At the end of it, she then introduced me to one of my childhood favorite rappers who actually owned the club. So, which is just a strange experience. It's just a bizarre experience where it was an Akinyele in the flesh. And and his songs were so explicit. The title of his songs was so explicit. I can't even say them on this podcast. But it was a fascinating night. But again, it was just her knowing her world and it being able to break it down for me. I thought, in the future, there's so much I want to learn about it. Yeah, and she gave me such an education on how it worked. And again, so I'm sure when with Chris Morris, when they wrote Four Lions, when Chris Morris, I think it's Chris Morris who wrote it, when he wrote Four Lions, yes, which is a brilliant film, truly brilliant film. I'm sure he probably did a bit of a deep dive into the world of terrorism, of terrorists from an Islamist background. And Steve, when you look at the sorts of characters, who was driven by what? The one character was just the guy who would have been a rebel in pretty much anything. And the one was actually, and there was only really one who really knew what he was doing, and even he regretted it in the end.
So. Yeah. I think I remember reading that he'd like researched it for four or 5 years before they actually wrote it.
I'm just racking my brains to try and think of some research that we could
do. I think a trip to Miami, Miami Strip Club, isn't it?
Yeah, got that unfortunately already, on the podcast budget, we're probably going to end up in a sharing one room in Blackpool. And we'll just have to take our own, we'll have to pipe our own oxygen in. We'll take a canister of oxygen and just release it into the
room. But a night out in Benson sounds like the way to go. I reckon.
You will see nothing but bulls or something in Benson. There bulls and cows. And that's pretty much it. That was my childhood. Quite literally, my foster mom, God rest her soul, would actually say to me, don't wear red to school and the bull might chase you. And it was and it was something I lived by for a very long time. I took it very seriously. In fact, I don't know if she was serious till this very day, whether or not she was joking. But it was something we just always say, don't wear red to school because you're going to aggravate the bulls. So you might get chased or you might get scared. And that was it. We never used to wear red to school. And it was a fascinating little period of my life. But there we go.
Well, Nels, thank you so much for coming on. That's been really good fun, really interesting as well. But we really appreciate you giving us your time.
Yes.
It'd be like, look, fellas, just sat down with three white guys who are calling themselves failing is an absolute delight to me. So it's been absolute fun. And thank you so much for your time. It's been great sport. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for the encouragement in relation to my writing and my work too. So much appreciated.
You're welcome. It's great.
Well, I feel like we've not gone far enough. Now we should hug you and cry on you.
I'm sure we'll bump into each other one of these days.
You just have to imagine that bit. Yeah. Imagine
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Well, take care of yourself, man.
Thank you so much, Nels. It's been a pleasure
to speak
to you.
Thanks, Nels. You take care, man.
Cheers.
Take
care. Cheers.
Bye. Well, I think the most pertinent part of that interview for me was I loved how casually he said, so yeah, I thought I was going to write a book, so I went to Vegas. Oh, and Miami. Just as if that's, why not? Yeah,
I mean, that's what expense accounts are for, isn't it?
Yeah, that's literally all it takes. Yeah, that's all you have to do.
That's where I've been going wrong.
That's what we've been missing out on. Yeah, where should we go? Where should we go? Because we've all got books ready. We just need to go to a foreign destination so that we can get it out there.
It's a pleasant contrast. When we did the interview with Simon about fucking apostrophes, he did something very, very similar, didn't he? Except he went to Scarborough. That was really interesting with Nels, wasn't it?
It was. There was some pretty hardcore content there, wasn't there, really? I like the way Nels answered my slightly trite question about what you'd do if you were king by just, casually dropping in that he'd pay reparations to all the countries that Britain has exploited and bankrupt the country.
Yeah.
And our reaction was okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Cool. Yeah. I suppose.
Makes sense. Yeah. Makes sense, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, I can sort of see his point.
It's not what I would do, but then
I mean,
you know,
I think what came across about him to me is that he didn't have an axe to grind with it. He wasn't. He was very pragmatic about it, without having any kind of chip on his shoulder, but still very honest and real, and wasn't backing down on stuff. I can see why it works in how he's sort of delivered his book in his personality.
Yeah. Yep.
Good stuff. Thank you very much for coming on and chatting to us now.
Yeah, and it's a good book, that. It's a real enlightening book.
And I have read that one as well. Yeah. I have read it. Ooh. All of it.
Get your hands on that one. Think Like a White Man.
Yeah.
It's good.
So what have we got coming up next then, chaps?
Well, after me sharing my
silly little sales book.
Silly little sales book.
Yep.
I was trying to think of something grander than that, but I couldn't bring myself to say it.
We need to stop calling it that at some point.
Possibly. It's probably slightly self-destructive, isn't it? My acerbic satire on the world of sales.
Yeah. Hard-hitting. Yeah.
Nice little sales.
And obviously then we strong-armed John into finally sharing his tree story, or certainly the first part of it on the end of last episode.
Yes.
He has sent the full version,
yep,
all four parts, rather than just that one part, through to myself and Dave. And at least half of us have read that.
But that way we're not going to reveal which half.
No. But suffice to say, I really enjoyed it. So maybe next week we should have a chat to John about his story.
We should give John some full and frank feedback.
Yeah, because I think that was
the deal, wasn't it?
That's part
that
of the
deal.
That is the deal.
All right, I'm up for that.
Okay.
Get ready, John.
Yeah, I'll prep myself.
Sharpening me pencil.
Probably should read it first, Dave.
Luckily, it is quite short, and it's a lot shorter than I thought it was, because I think I said it was 20,000. It's actually only 10,000.
Is it? That's good.
I was confusing it with something
else.
It might
be more entertaining, Dave, if you don't read it and just
still give feedback.
Some really sharp, cutting feedback still.
Yeah. Okay, that would be quite an interesting exercise to give full and frank feedback without ever actually... It'd be like a politician worthy. So I could say loads of stuff really passionately, yeah, but not actually say anything throughout the whole thing. Might give that a go. I mean, I've made it this far through.
That's what we'll do next week. Next week, we'll guess whether Dave's feedback is indeed genuine or just made up waffle bonnets. Who knows? You decide.
Does that mean I have to do another part now?
If you're happy releasing it, if you don't think it's...
Will it affect sales? I don't know.
Part,
yeah.
So, keep listening after the end of this and John will have done part two and we'll put it on the end.
Hang on.
What? Strike while the iron's hot. Then we can get him 1, 2, 3, 4 in a row after... You don't
just
want leaving gaps,
that.
Do we?
Just stop
Actually,
saying
if you
it.
Could do parts, if you did parts 2 and 3 for this week... We can put the final part on after we rip it to pieces next
week.
Anyway,
it's 5 parts, Tom. It's 5 parts.
And then people can be... He's added another part now.
I thought it ended quickly. I thought it was a bit weird. Didn't really finish. Didn't conclude. Didn't tie up.
Sense.
Yeah. All right. 5 parts, is it? Right. Yeah. No, whatever. However many parts it is.
Yeah. Well, at least I don't have to read the first
That's
part.
True.
You can just listen to it on the end of last week's episode, yeah.
Because you can read it. You
snuggle
read
down
it
in
me.
Bed and listen to that one.
Yeah, and then read the rest.
Well.
But I look forward to that. I look forward to ripping you apart immensely, John, next week.
Whether he's ready or not. Who cares?
It's like a preemptive strike before we do give feedback on yours.
Exactly. I know what's coming. I know what's coming. So getting it out there, because the next in the series of... horrendous feedback episodes will be you two ripping apart my little silly little war book. So
everyone's gonna look forward to that.
But until then, dear listeners, thanks for being dear listeners.
Yeah, thanks.
And if you want to become dear reviewers, you can always leave us a review on our website, failingwriterspodcast.com. Or you could chip in with something else there. If you wanted to.
There's not a lot else to be said there, is there?
All right.
Goodbye. Leave us a review.
No, fair enough.
Tell your friends.
Leave us a review. Yeah.
It's fizzled out. I think the end of this episode, if anything, has fizzled.
I think it did, didn't it? Just sort of, it's like a firework. But do we go back to it?
You shouldn't go back to a firework.
You shouldn't go back to a lit firework, even if it's definitely
though,
out.
It? Tempting.
No, leave it. Just leave it.
I remember
walk
as a
away.
Kid, that was a very stressful situation as a
God,
kid.
God,
it is,
it? Isn't it?
Mm. Fireworks thing, and then someone just be, oh, everything I've been told as a kid was don't go back to a lit firework.
There would always be someone, usually mum, who would shout just as you got near it, oh, don't go back to it! Just to really, terrify you.
Yeah.
But you're right, we should have just left it where it ended. Shouldn't have.
Yeah.
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 Mm. And we have now gone back to it.
Burnt me face
off.
Do you know what else is stressful? It's very similar to going back to a lit firework. Don't know if you ever listen to Five Live, but when they're coming up to the top of the hour and it's the news time and they say interviewing someone or whatever, or they've got a caller on, they start playing the bed to come out of it. Ding, 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 ding. And that really stresses me out, that. Because the person's still talking and it's not like they're not near the end of a sentence. And you can hear the presenter not really wanting to interrupt them, but knowing that they've got to interrupt them. And there'll be a little gap and they'll go, but, and then the person will just keep speaking. And you're like, oh my God, but the news, the bed's on, the music's
Daily
on.
Daily politics is bad for that as well. Because the titles start coming up the screen as well as the music playing. And you can see the presenter, when you do that nod, which says, yep, got it. Enough, and they just keep on.
Yeah,
going.
I'm using non-visual cues, visual cues,
and then
everything.
Right, just as it fades to black, she just screams goodbye, and that's the end.
Yeah,
yeah.
Politicians have got to be the worst as well, haven't they?
Yeah.
You know what I mean,
they just don't know when to quit, when to end, when to just say, that's enough. Let's just leave it there.
I'm glad we're not like that.
No.
God. Yeah, thank God for that.
That would be frustrating both for us and the listeners.
And anyone listening still, yeah.
If we were talking now and we can hear the music coming up underneath, I'm thinking, well, there's not even an end point to this. It's just waffle. Yeah. Literally, now.
And the music has just been going and going. Hang on. Wait, I can hear that bit coming at the app. Here it comes.
Yeah.
There it is.
There we so we need to stop talking now, because otherwise we're going to put right over the end.
Yeah, that's great.
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
Cheers, guys.
Bye.
Yep.
Bye.
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 Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?
The Ancient, Part 2. 6th of May, 1958. Dear Betty, it's been a long time since I last wrote to you. I hope you and your family are well. I expect I'd get a shock if I saw your children now. Handsome little things, I imagine, judging from their parents. I've been away studying forestry and arboriculture. Become a complete bore about the subject, to be honest. And it's hardly one of those topics that lights up parties in the first place. Oh, you must meet Alfred. His story about changes in chlorophyll production in ash trees is just riveting. I didn't think I'd love studying so much, to be honest. If you can remember my O-level results, you'd know what I'm talking about. I'm not here long, by the way. I only came back to visit Mum's grave and see how the forest was faring. To be honest, I very nearly didn't check the old yew. I was certain I would only find my old missives rotting inside. I was thrilled, however, when I saw your letter instead. It's not dated, so I can't be certain when you wrote it, but it looks quite old. Thank you for responding, though, Betty. It means a lot. I'm sorry if my letters made you feel uneasy. It wasn't, and will never be my intention to upset you. I hope, with so much time having passed, that this reply is less troubling to you. I just felt it was wrong to leave your letter unanswered. I feel like I've grown up a lot in the last few years, made peace with some things, reset my priorities, and, yeah, become far duller than I ever was before. I will post this in the tree, but I don't expect a reply. This may even be the last communication we have. Perhaps that wouldn't be such a bad idea. However, I couldn't resist this small parting gift for you. I hope you don't mind. It's just something I came across recently, and I felt somehow sure you'd like it. Fingers crossed you find it safe. Yours always, Alfred.
The light run flickered, and the cycles rolled. We budded, we foliated, we blossomed, we seeded, we discarded, we slept, over and over. This was the time the flat seeders began to wilt and die, sending out their death pain, the rest of us powerless to help. Still, she came to us, rushing among our boughs with the old, soft, comforting tread, lingering by the ancients and the dying, listening, breathing us in. Sometimes in the shadow time, the heavy foot came, returning to the place where the hard sticks of old life lay in the ground, betwined in our roots.
14th of July, 1963. Dear Alfred, I stopped visiting our private post box some years ago. It became too painful a game, so I gave up hope that you'd reply. I suppose, judging by your last letter, so would you. It was only because Hazel has a friend who lives near Mum's old house that I happened to be passing right by the old yew on Friday. 5 years your letter's been sitting there. 5 years. How did it go so quickly, Alfred? Hazel's 14 now, a real tomboy, unafraid of anything or anyone. Outwardly, she's so much tougher than Alfie, which of course breaks Stanley's heart, especially as he's never shown the slightest interest in rugby. Stanley says he wishes he could exchange their personalities. He's wrong, though. They're perfect the way they are. Alfie so funny and warm, and Hazel, brave and sharp as a tack. Alfie, I just realised, is the same age as me when we first met. 16. Do you ever think of those days? Half a lifetime ago.
Thanks for the gift. It was very kind of you. Although I confess I haven't listened to much jazz in the last few years. Well, any really. Stanley's not a big fan, especially when I play the gramophone at a decent volume. So I've got quite out of the habit. How wonderful, then, to be reminded. I played the first track, St. Thomas, yesterday evening when Stanley was at the pub and was transported. Hazel and I danced round the living room like lunatics. I loved it. I hadn't heard of Sonny Rollins before, but I'm officially his biggest fan now. Thank you, Alfred. I don't know when you'll get this letter. I sometimes wonder what it will be like to see you again after so many years. I expect you'd find me quite disappointing. I'm not as slim as I once was and beginning to grey already. In some regards, corresponding like this is preferable to meeting. I like to think of those two young people, captured in some sort of time bubble, the youthful versions of us, full of energy and ideas, not this tired old housewife with nothing of interest to say. I think it's wonderful that you studied trees, by the way. I have to admit to being equally as fascinated, quite jealous, in fact. I've spent hours wandering the forest over the last 10 years or so, making sketches, watching how different species behave and seem to interact with one another. This is going to sound silly, I know, but do you ever wonder if forests are more aware than they let on? I'm sure there's something about those great noble beings we're overlooking. As a thank you for your kind gift, I'm leaving you a book I enjoyed recently. You may have read it, but if you haven't, I think you will appreciate its general philosophy. Thank you for writing that letter, Alfred. Perhaps I'll hear from you again one day. Take care, and best of luck with whatever it is you find yourself doing. Betty.
In those cycles of the great light, we began to sense the world breath thicken, only by a root hair at first, but enough that we grew well those years, the warm time coming along, the sky water falling and falling. She was around us so often then, becoming one of us, seeking with the tendrils of her roots and mingling with ours in the stillness of our midst. Her visits to the Redberry Ancient became fewer, but she would still come often to us, her sniffer bounding among our trunks. Every so often she would climb up into the fork of the great seed giver as she used to. One light run, as the dew gathered, we felt her soft tread approaching. Close behind, the stop-start stumbling of heavy, unsteady feet, stalking through the low growth, staying in the shadows, silent and watching.
29th of May, 1971. Dearest Betty, first of all, thank you for your letter. I was thrilled to find it. I'm sorry I didn't get it sooner. I've been in South America for the past few years. I was asked by a group of Brazilian activists to help them find ways of preventing illegal logging. The speed of clearing there is frightening. Since they began the Trans-Amazonian Highway, the forest is more accessible, fair game for logging and slash-and-burn farming. It's like watching crowds of innocents being slaughtered, Betty, and mostly we're helpless to stop it. Entire species are wiped out on a daily basis. Meanwhile, Medici is only interested in growing the economy. The Sand County Almanac makes the point beautifully. Thank you so much for the copy. The wilderness isn't just a resource to be exploited. There has to be a mutual relationship between humans and the land. Otherwise, in a very short space of time, there'll be no more natural environment left. And no, Betty, what you wrote about trees isn't ridiculous at all. In fact, you don't know how wonderful it is to see those words written down by you. Speaking of which, I learned a wonderful new word recently, and I think it applies very well to the likes of us. Nemophilist, one who loves the forest. Oh God, there I go. You see, I warned you about this in my last letter. I've become a total bloody bore on the topic. Change of subject. I hope you're all doing well. Your children sound like wonderful people. In fact, they're not actually children anymore, are they? They must be in their 20s. Now there's another terrifying thought. I'm glad you like the record. I haven't listened to very much jazz either over the last few years. The only music I had access to in Brazil was the folk songs we played in the evenings around the fire, which I have a feeling you would have liked. I still think of you often, Betty. I hope it's okay for me to say that now so many years have gone by, but it's true. I confess, I came to your house last night after I found your letter. I'd only planned to say hello and find out how you are, but then I caught a glimpse of you through a window, and it suddenly felt like a terrible idea. I hope I did the right thing. Thank you again for the letter, Betty. Look after yourself. Love, Alfred.
The Guardian was back. He came to the Redberry agent, wrapped his warm boughs around the soft, supple bark. From there, strode in sweeping spirals, his easy, confident step circling into us. But once the great light came, he'd gone. Soon after, the heavy foot returned, sometimes kicking low growth, snapping off thin stems, cawing, a sound like the shimmer blacks, who took flight, scattering shadows.
3rd of June, 1971. Dear Alfred, I must see you. I'll be at our post drop at 10 p.m, Thursday, 10th of June. Yours truly, Betty.
6th of June, 1971. Dear Betty, I'm still in town. I'm staying at Joe Finch's for a couple of weeks while I work out what to do next. Remember Joe? Of course I'll meet you, Betty. I can't think of anything I'd like to do more. See you then. Love, Alfred. P.S. I hope you're okay. Your reply was so short, and your writing looked strained, as though you were in a hurry or you hurt your hand.
It was the shadow time, and the heavy foot arrived, sour breath, spraying trunks with his acid and burning in the dark for prey. Then we felt the Guardian come, moving closer. No way to warn him what waited for him there. He called out, but the other was on him so quick, answering his cry with a dead Redberry limb that felled him straight. For days, we tasted the sour iron sap that oozed from his wounds.
10th of June, 1971. Dear Alfred, please tell me what just happened. Stanley came home drunk this evening, covered in blood. He said you wouldn't be writing any more letters. I don't know how he found out, but more importantly, what does he mean? I pleaded with him, but he refused to talk. Oh, God. Alfred, I hope you're all right. I tried to call Joe just now, but there's no reply. Please let me know you're well. Stanley's not himself at the moment. He's drinking so much. I can't imagine he'd do something stupid, but he seems to get angry so easily nowadays. God knows how I get this to the U. I'll have to sneak out tonight when he's asleep. I've just come back from Joe's. I couldn't sleep all night, so I walked to his house early this morning before Stanley woke up. No one's answering the door. I'm a little frantic now. Please leave me a message as soon as you can, Alfred. Love, Betty.
12th of June, 1971. Dear Betty, I'm sorry for worrying you. Please don't anymore. I was only in hospital overnight for observation, but I'm feeling fine. I've discharged myself. Joe's been incredible, but I think you'll be glad to see the back of me. If you're reading this, it means you found the picture of the beach Joe posted through your letterbox early this morning. I thought it better to pin this letter to our beech tree, as your husband knows about the yew tree now. I'm so sorry, Betty, about all of this. I take full responsibility. Stanley was only doing what most men would do if they found out someone had been sending their wife secret letters on and off for the past 35 years. Christ knows I might have done worse if it had been me. So I'm leaving town, Betty. For good. It's for the best. The thing is, I never meant for any of this. Stanley must have followed you to the U at some point, worked out what was going on, then a week or so ago found the letter I left for you. It seems he replied, impersonating your handwriting, asking to meet. Regrettably, I fell for it. And more unfortunately still, he'd had rather a lot to drink, and so the meeting did not go particularly well, especially for me. It was a mistake to come back. I'm so sorry if I've got you into trouble. I'm aware that despite the broken arm and the concussion, I still don't have to live with him. I may well have made things very difficult for you at home. I hope I'm wrong. Please let me know you're okay. If you're able to drop a letter to Joe, he'll forward it to me. I won't complicate your life anymore. You mean far too much to me to ever see you hurt. Goodbye, Betty. Love, Alfred.
14th of June, 1971. Dear Alfred, don't you bloody dare leave without saying goodbye. Not again. Damn it, Alfred. I'm sorry, but you really piss me off sometimes. You always say you're leaving for my sake, that it's for the best, so I don't get hurt. But how do you know what hurts? I'm sick and tired of you running away and hearing nothing from you for years. You first did that 35 years ago, and I don't want to go through it again. I found your note on the beech tree today. However much you tried to deny it, you began something all those years ago, Alfred, when you etched our initials in the bark. Look at how the letters have spread and bulged with time. Notice how they haven't faded. If anything, they've grown with the tree, bigger, deeper, and wider. When I spotted that today, Alfred, I knew. I got that familiar sock in the guts, the same as I get when I see one of your letters. Elation and dread in equal measures, and the preposterous drumming in my chest, like some 16-year-old girl leaning into her first kiss. It was suddenly so obvious to me what was going on, has always been going on. I'm sick and tired of pretending. I'm 50 years old, for God's sake. Yes, I have two grown-up children, a husband who earns very good money. I have, for the most part, a nice, quiet, stable existence in a nice, quiet part of the world. And I have everything I could ever need. Apart from one thing, the one bloody thing I really want, I can't have. I've never had. So don't you dare just bugger off again. Not without at the very least saying goodbye. You owe me that, Alfred Dalton. Betty. P.S. I bought you another gift. Call it a parting gift if you insist. It's in the crook of the trunk. Perhaps it will help you understand.
16th of June, 1971. Dear Betty. Thank you. A love supreme has been playing on Joe's record player non-stop. 2 o'clock, Saturday, 25th of June, here. Alfred.